Well, let me tell you about First Sound's most recent adventures in archaeophany. Patrick and I, along with Richard and Martin and Megan Hennessy, are the founders of First Sounds. It was 2 years ago, while drinking copious quantities of Italian beer at a very forgettable spaghetti joint, when we first put forth the audacious proposition that defines our endeavor. We posited that First Sounds could help make mankind's earliest sound recordings available to all people for all time, simply by facilitating the efforts of like-minded individuals. The contributors to our loose collaborative all share our belief and our passion. They include scientists from Lawrence Berkeley Laboratories, forensics experts from the FBI, Grammy-winning sound engineers, audio historians, translators, photographers, a whole gamut of skilled people who freely give their time and resources to be part of this work. The advances that we'll discuss this morning are all made possible by their personal commitments and their collaborative spirit. When we established First Sounds 2 years ago, the earliest sounds anyone could hear were recorded in 1888. That same year, Arthur Sullivan of Gilbert and Sullivan attended a phonographic soiree and after dinner recorded this message to Thomas Edison.
For myself, I can only say that I am astonished and somewhat terrified at the result of this evening's experiment. Astonished at the wonderful power you have developed, terrified at the thought that so much hideous dance music may be put on record forever.
The phonograph was invented at the end of 1877, so between 1878 and 1888 is a 10-year window in which recordings were made, but which nobody living today had heard. We asked, do any of these survive? You know, Edison's recording of Mary Had a Little Lamb is lost forever, if in fact it ever existed. I've examined one tinfoil recording, which is pretty good provenance and purports to contain the voice of Sarah Bernhardt, made during a visit to Edison's lab. And there are other recordings scattered here and there that were made after the invention of the phonograph, but before Edison's introduction of the wax cylinder in 1888, but we really haven't heard any. One cache of recordings were made just a few months after the invention of the phonograph. Edison's assistant, Charles Batchelor, built a machine in the summer of 1878 to capture on paper the sounds of the newly constructed and annoyingly noisy elevated railroad in Manhattan. These recordings were traced on paper covered with a fine layer of soot, and they exist today in the care of the Edison National Historic Center. One of First Sound's first accomplishments was to prove that these recordings could, in fact, be played back. Working with Jerry Fabris at the site, we made very high-resolution optical scans of each sheet. We processed the images for clarity and then sent them to Carl Haber and Earl Cornell at Lawrence Berkeley Labs, who were able to convert them into sounds. On December 13, 2007, a snippet of one of these recordings became the very first sound from before 1888 to be heard by modern ears. Ooh. you hear are tests, you know, testing 1, 2, 3. This is not speed corrected, it's not restored, but it's not sexy, but it's a proof of concept that happened, that we were able to accomplish in December of 07. Now, Edison could have recorded these sounds onto foil and played them back in his lab, but he recorded them on paper because he wanted to examine them visually. Now, this was not a new idea. Airborne sounds had been traced onto paper since the early 1860s by a machine called the phonautograph. At that time, any well-appointed cabinet of acoustical instruments required a phonautograph to compare, say, the qualities of airborne sounds or to establish their pitch. Experimenters could buy a phonautograph from an instrument maker, such as the great Rudolf Koenig of Paris, here on the left, or they could make their own. Alexander Graham Bell, here in Washington, D.C., was one of these do-it-yourselfers. His phonautograph used the ear of a cadaver, cut right out of a dead guy's skull, to trace sounds in 1874. There's a picture of it. It's not too detailed on purpose. But again, back when we started, we didn't know if any phonautographic recordings made in the 1860s or 1870s survived. Of course, we had heard of this French guy, Edward Leon Scott de Martinville, who invented the phonautograph that Rudolf Koenig sold from his atelier in Paris. We knew that Leon Scott, which is how he signed his name, had applied for a patent on his invention in 1857, and that he appended his application in 1859. ARSC member George Brock Nanstedt had recently translated these brevets of invention into English, but questions remained, and so I went to Paris to take a closer look. This is Valerie Marshall and Steve Galizia of the French Patent Office, or INPI as it's known. Valerie and Steve are great friends of the First Sounds Initiative. They exhumed for us Scott's original documents and made it possible to make high-resolution scans of the complete brevets. The patent documents show us the early development of Scott's phonautograph. His 1857 machine here on the left recorded on a flat sled that just simply moved across a tabletop. His 1859 machine recorded on a revolving cylinder. Now, this had been about as far as anyone had pursued the work of Leon Scott. And we wanted to know more, so we commissioned a scan of a rare book in the French National Library, written by Scott himself in 1878 in response to Edison's invention of the phonograph. Because you see, in the spring of winter and spring of 1878, Edison was receiving like all sorts of accolades for his invention, and nobody was talking about poor old Leon Scott. So he wrote this book in which he implored his countrymen to say, he said, "Come, Parisians, don't let them take our prize. I beseech all stout-hearted men, and thank God some still remain, to proclaim my name in this manner. For I am getting old, the father of two sons, and all I can leave them is my good name." He died about a year later. Scott did us a great favor by writing this book, because in it, he printed the text of every document he thought significant in the development of his invention. So for instance, here in his table of contents, we see the two brevets, the original patent application and then the addition, the certificate of addition in 1859. It's a very fascinating one here, a communication to the Society of Encouragement in 1857. We didn't exactly know what that was. Patrick did some looking around, and we found, unfortunately, in this fine academic journal, the History of Science Society, that the Society for Encouragement for National Industries archives had unfortunately been lost, and so we did not pursue that. Also, in Scott's book, he mentions two deposits at the French Academy of Sciences, one in 1857 in January, which was just 2 months before his first patent application, The second in 1861. So our researcher in Paris, Aline Gatignon, went to the French Academy of Sciences and ordered up copies for me to look at here in the States. These arrived at my home on February 29th of last year. It came on a CD, and as I opened each image on the CD, I saw stuff like this: Scott's handwritten explanation of his approach, his procedures, his equipment, his experiments, and then there, in frustratingly fuzzy, low-res, JPEG, artifact-ridden focus, were phonautograms, beautiful phonautograms. One right after another, seven full sheets in all from 1860, and then there were pieces of others going back as far as 1853. Not only were we looking at Scott's first proof of concept, from what I could tell, there appeared to be several playable phonautograms from 1860, 28 years before the Crystal Palace recordings, 18 years before the elevated railway recordings, 17 years before Edison invented the phonograph. Edison would have been 13 years old at the time. The archives sent us the best scans they could, but our technical specifications are quite stringent. So Patrick, René Rondeau, and I talked it over. It was less than a month before our session at the ARS conference at Stanford. We knew our recovery of sounds from Edison's phonautograms would be noteworthy, but the evocation of a French folk song sung in 1860, that would be newsworthy. So, should I take a trip to Paris and get better scans? Could we, in fact, negotiate the privilege of scanning in the archives? Would there be enough time to process those images once we got them back? With only a few weeks before the ARS conference, it was just a really huge gamble. But we took it. I enlisted my friend and French science writer, Isabelle Trocherie, to come along with me to Paris as a translator. We flew to Paris, did the work, and with the help of many people, our gamble paid off. Our results were indeed newsworthy. We had recovered for everyone to hear mankind's first recording of its own voice. We had prepared a press release with all the basic information, but let me tell you, when the New York Times breaks your story on the front page, you don't need no stinking press release. Poor Jerry McBride and Nathan Georgiadis and Brenda Nelson Strauss and our hosts at Stanford had to accommodate TV crews, radio journalists, reporters from local papers, the AP, UPI, AFP. You know, every time I ran into Steve Ram, he reported how many more hundreds of Google hits, you know, we were getting.
The American Thomas Edison is widely regarded as the father of recorded sound. But there are claims now that Mr. Edison was beaten to it by 17 years by a Frenchman. Audio historians have dug up a recording made in 1860 on what's known as a phone autograph, a device created by Parisian inventor Edouard Léon Scott de Martinville, and for the first time found a way of playing the sound out loud. On the short clip, a woman can be heard singing Au clair de la lune. And I spoke earlier to the inventor's great-grandson, Laurent Scott de Martinville, and played that recording to him the first time he had heard it.
I'm so happy for him because in his last will, he asked his children and grandchildren to make sure that his discovery would not be ignored. This is a moral task that was given to us by his own handwritten will, which this one I have at home, and we were particularly proud in the family. We tried to restore his memory, my father and also my grandfather, and they had a marble plate that was put on the wall of the National Library, Rue Vivienne in Paris. That was the place where he lived for the last period of his life and where he passed away. And on this plate, it is said that he had invented how to record sounds. As a matter of fact, when he passed away, he had just been as a spectator assisting to the presentation of Mr. Edison's invention in Paris. And his name was not even mentioned, and he was so upset that I believe that this is one of the reasons that eventually ended tragically.
This is going to require the rewriting an awful lot of history books, isn't it?
Well, only a few sentences, but key ones.
Oh, Scott DeMartin.
As you can tell, Laurent is a diplomat. I mean, quite literally, having spent 20 years in China negotiating trade agreements between the French and Chinese. Not only has he opened the family archives for us, but he's also opened doors for us in France that only a French citizen with his skill set could do. Fact is, Laurent played important roles in our next two archaeophonic discoveries. The first was in November of last year, but the story begins a few months earlier, in March of last year. I had just returned from Paris with the Academy scans with Eau Claire when Patrick called with some good news. He found an opaque reference to sound inscriptions in the papers of Henri Victor Regnault at the Institute of France's library. Now, that was the good news. See, the bad news was this library was right across the courtyard from where I'd been 3 days before. The other bit of discouraging news was that we would need a personal recommendation from a member of the library just to set foot inside. This library is for members only. We put that challenge aside for the summer while we worked on other things. In November, Laurent and I met with the perpetual secretary of the French Academy of Sciences in his office in Paris. We had with us photographer Karen Ackerson. Jean Dercourt is a gracious host who insisted on hanging our coats himself and conducting the meeting in English. He congratulated us on our discoveries and our achievements. We expressed our gratitude to the Academy. We marveled at the preservation of the Scott documents through revolutions in government, two world wars, domestic social upheavals. He said, yeah, but, you know, look, that's our job. And when you think about it, the Academy was already 200 years old when Scott put the stuff in, so we had kind of been used to it. Laurent and I asked if it would be possible to search for the sound inscriptions in the Regnault dossier. And Mr. Dercourt replied, but of course. He would write us personal letters so that we could enter the Institute's library that very afternoon. So we walked back across the courtyard while we waited for these letters. Where Madame Greff and I introduced Laurent to his great-grandfather's papers, including the now iconic Eau Claire. I have to tell you that meetings like this across time between Laurent and his great-grandfather have really been some of the most gratifying experiences in this whole endeavor. Well, we finally got the papers, so we walked back across the courtyard. We presented our papers at the door and started our walk down this long corridor towards the librarian's desk. Now, understand, we are obviously very eager to get started on this search, but the whole gravitas of this place caused us to walk, you know, slowly, reverently. The herringbone floorboards of this temple creaked, you know, with each step. And at one point, we stopped, Ront and I, we kind of looked at each other and remarked, how we felt like Indiana Jones in the quest for forgotten scriptures. Anyway, 20 minutes later, we're sitting at a massive oak table examining two large envelopes stuffed with Regnault's papers. Laurent took the correspondence file, because I don't read French, and I took the file with the drawings. And in fact, going through document by document, unfolding them all, looking at them, I'd almost worked through the entire stack, but then our treasure emerged. It was a small folio, folded in half, about the same size, same look and feel of the phonautograms I'd first seen in March. And you know, this is a very quiet place, and I'm going nuts. I mean, Laurent's right here, and I'm saying, we found it, dude. And he's going nuts, and Karen's going nuts because she can't take pictures in now. But together, we turned each page, read the liner notes his great-grandfather inscribed in the smoke of 8 phonautograms, all made in 1860, April of 1860, just days, literally days, after Eau Claire. You'll note that Scott tied these phonautograms together into what we know as the very first record album. Which he humbly presented to Victor Regnault in gratitude for his continuing support, guidance and support. Now, back last year in December, I went to France and I formally petitioned the commission of the library, respectfully requesting permission to make high-resolution scans of these magnificent documents so that we could study them, so that we could share them with scholars. We also invited the Institute of France to join with us in releasing their sounds. When we release sounds, we release them as a gift to all humanity because we believe they are the patrimony of all mankind. We're told that the commission will give this matter all due attention. To date, our request remains unanswered, and I fear the Regnault phonautograms may suffer the same fate as the lost Ark of the Covenant. But I'm not dwelling on it because literally, the very next morning, we got a new lead. We were back at the French Patent Office. Valerie and Steve had invited Laurent to come in and see, again, for the first time, his great-grandfather's patent applications. You know, we looked at the documents together, and each page, you know, I'd tell a story about something we learned from that page or something we'd learned about that page since we started studying it. Laurent read to us from his great-grandfather's copy, his own copy, of the 1878 book, where Leon Scott tells how the patent application in front of us was supported by the Society for the Encouragement of National Industry. Well, I lamented the loss of the Society's archives, as reported in that august academic journal, The History of Science Society. Don't get me started on academic journals. At that point, Valerie started speaking very rapidly to Laurent in French. I don't understand, but it was clear that something was up. And then she left the room. If you ever want to conduct research at INPI, you'll want a copy of this guide to the archives, which was written by Valerie and her colleague, Gerard Emtos. Laurent told me why Valerie left the room. He said, you know, Valerie left to call Professor Emtos. He is in charge of the Society for Encouragement's archives. She will ask him to look for the Scott dossier. I presume you are okay with that. Professor Emtos was out of the office, but just days later we were corresponding again across the Atlantic by mail, email. And in one email I wrote, Scott presented prints of phonautograms to the Society on October 28, 1857. If they survive in your archives, they would be among the earliest recordings of airborne sounds in existence. To that email, a few days later, Gerard wrote back, we have located a dossier of 36 documents comprised of correspondence and various experiments. In our opinion, this exceptional file should make it possible to reconstitute with precision the advancements made by Scott in concert with the Society. What seemed to us, he continued, most exceptional are the original sheets of recorded sounds. They are quite fragile documents, being of black smoke deposited on thin paper. We invite you to Paris to scan these documents. Although an appointment will be necessary, I have available Friday, December 5th. Well, I received this letter on Saturday, November 29th. But on Friday, December 5th, I was in Paris, this time with Mike DeVecca as translator and photographer. Now, it was immediately evident that these would be some of our most important excavations to date. Direct evidence of what Scott did, when he did it, over the course of a whole year, 1857, of experimentation. And I felt as if our pursuit of the earliest sound recordings had kind of like wrapped back in time to converge with Scott's own. You know, because we were both now in the same groove, and the sounds encoded in that groove are what we both were seeking to understand. After our new days, after a day with our new friends at the Society, and with a scanner in tow on the way back to the hotel, I called Patrick with the news.
This is Paris calling. We found 28 phonautograms from 1857. I think that there's one that was done on the sled. I think that the rest of them were done on a cylinder. They look, as you said, they have some very crazy waveforms on them. They all seem to be original, and none of them are playable. None of them. We won't hear any interpretable sound, I don't think, off of any of them.
Patrick will pick up the story from here.